Our main speaker tonight is Joey.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joey. I'm a real alcoholic. And I want to thank God for allowing me to be here today, and also by his grace and mercy for separating me from alcohol since March 15th, 1991. And it's truly a miracle that I stand before you this evening, you know. I'd like to start out with a short prayer to a universal God to get me centered, to allow God into the building. It is a church. You can welcome him in. And hopefully I don't offend anybody by a short prayer. And I'd like to say, Dear Lord, Heavenly Father, Father of Light, who presides over each and every one of us, Lord, I want to thank you once again for allowing me to stand before your children, Lord. Thank you once again, Lord, for allowing me to help to share your love and your understanding, your compassion, and your way of life by telling people how I developed the relationship with you. Amen. You know, a lot of people like to refer to page 58 when they tell their story and say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But there's another way in our literature that it tells us how we should tell our story, and it's on page 29 in the big book. And it says, each individual, in his own language and from his own point of view, will let us know how we establish our relationship with God. And I established my relationship by God in not the most nice way. Let's put it that way. And when I tell you my story, you'll understand what I mean. I grew up with an alcoholic father. And to give you a description of my dad, I like the effect produced by alcohol before I even drank. And you might be saying, how can that be? Well, I had a father that was restless, irritable, and discontent. And he was a short order cook in a restaurant in New Brunswick. And he would come home about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, miserable from work. And he would lay down on the couch, and he would wake up from a nap around 4:30, 5 o'clock when my mom got home. And she was the good old Al-Anon. And she'd cook him a steak while we all ate mashed potatoes and eggs and stuff like that. And my father would start leaving the dinner table and going into the laundry room and coming back to the dinner table. And slowly but surely, my father, over a period of time during the course of dinner, would go from restless, irritable, and discontent to happy, joyous, and free. And I didn't know what was taking place in that laundry room until I knew what was taking place in that laundry room. And what was taking place in that laundry room is my dad had this little brown bottle. It had a name on there. It was Fleischmann. And it was 100 proof whiskey. And that was my first drink. I was born and raised in New Brunswick in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, Puerto Rican neighborhood. And which were they referred to as a project. There wasn't too many white families. It was during a time where there was race riots and, you know, National Guard in the school system. And you had a fight in that neighborhood. And you had to get tough in that neighborhood. And that neighborhood, when I first wrote inventory for the first time, and I got to look at the role that I assigned myself with my self-esteem, I realized that I didn't even get to assign myself what role I played. The neighborhood gave me the assignment of the role. You know, you don't walk away from a fight. You never run. You don't tell on your friends, and you don't tell the cops nothing. You do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it, and that's what you do, you know. And you drink this, you take that, you shoot this. And I realized that that's my deep belief systems in my life became as a result of the environment that I grew up in. And for a long time, you know, I spent 14 and a half years of my life in the penitentiaries in the state of New Jersey. My first reformatory number as a young baby alcoholic and a baby addict was 94227. My first state prison number when I turned 18 years of age was 78216. My first federal number after I was around the system for a while was 28541050. 050, I was from New Jersey. And I don't say that stuff to say, oh, I'm a tough guy or this and that. I tell you that because when I get to finish my story, I'm going to tell you what God is. You know, our literature says the dilemma of the alcoholic is a lack of power, right? If you look up the word dilemma, dilemma is a difficult choice between two alternatives. You know, and from a guy like me, from a neighborhood that I came up from, was either, here was the two alternatives, that dilemma of growing up in my neighborhood. One, you were dead before you were 21. Two, you were doing a long length of time before you were 15. That was the alternatives. What I found out later, after I came around this room for a while, is that I had a much better alternative. My alternative later on was, because I was crushed by a self-imposed crisis that I couldn't postpone or evade any longer, I had to fearlessly face the fact that either God was everything or God was nothing. He had to be. For a guy like me, from the neighborhood I come from the environments I come from the lifestyle I live, from the things I've done, there's no choice for a guy like me. Is it a choice for me to go back to that type of stuff? Absolutely not. So I was raised in this neighborhood by a loving, loving, caring little Italian lady. Her name was Anna. It was my mom. I love her. She was an angel. And her father was a bookmaker. And he got busted in around 1977, 1978. And the Star Ledger in New Jersey had Kingpin on it. And my mother, later on in life, when I realized after making amends to my mom, where my mom came from. When I made amends to my mom for a whole lot of hurt and pain and devastation that I caused her, and I can't imagine the depth of the pain that I caused her. But when I made amends to my mom gave me a simple request: don't fight with your brother John. And at the time, it seemed like a simple little request. Don't fight with your brother John. What I found out later, through going through some therapy with one of my sisters, some family therapy, is that my mother on Easter Sunday 1969 witnessed her mother murdered by her brother. And that's what my mother brought into the marriage when she married this crazy Irish father that I got, that was a two-fisted whiskey drinker. And that if he came home with the paycheck, that was good. And if he didn't, that was okay too. That's the way it was. It was just a matter of fact. And I grew up in this household with 10 other brothers and sisters. I was the third youngest of 11. And I did the best I could for what mom and dad gave me. But I realized real early on, as a result of experimenting with alcohol and other substances, that I got to get out of this house, man. If I wanted to survive, I couldn't stay there, because I was either going to kill one of my siblings or I was going to get killed. And right around sixth or seventh grade, I don't know how old you are, 12 or 13 years old, I had a brother. He was my oldest. He was a heroin addict. He was one of these guys that was left over from the 60s. His name was Bobo. He was a nice, nice guy. And he was going to a program in California called Synanon. And he went out to Synanon in California, and he came back, and he just wasn't the same person anymore. He was, something drastically happened, both in his bodily and his mental sense. He definitely, and it wasn't like the difference between Ebby when Bill seen him. It was a drastic difference. And what happened was, he went over there, somehow or another got involved with the wrong people, and he came back, and he was drugged with LSD out there and came back as schizophrenic. And when he came back, he was incarcerated in Bordentown, New Jersey, where I was later on in life. And he stabbed somebody in a riot in Bordentown, and they bring him to the Vroom building in Trenton. And I know a lot of you guys are from New York, but the equivalent to the Vroom building in New York would be like the lowest maximum security segregation unit in Sing Sing for the criminally insane on top of it. And he came back from that environment, and it wasn't like, you know, like nowadays you have all these drug court and you have this intervention stuff and you have, transitional housing. One minute you were in the belly of the beast, next minute you were walking down George Street, and that's how they released him. And he came home, and he was exactly the same person when he wasn't taking medicine. And he started threatening my mother, my father, my brothers. He nailed down the windows in the house. He started the house on fire. And my father had to make a difficult decision. And my father made a decision on January 4th, 1977 to commit him back into a mental institution. He was 25 years old. He was a heroin addict. And he was living a life of untreated addiction. And that was January 4th, 1977, at about 3 o'clock in the morning. I remember my mom getting up. We slept in bunk beds like barracks. And it was me and my four brothers in the back room of the house. And I remember, like it was yesterday, on the radio was playing "You Told My Whole World Misty Blue" was on the radio. And I remember my mom, I was probably about 13 years old. I remember my mom waking up my oldest brother, Tommy, who's a full-blooded alcoholic today, and telling him that my brother, Bo, hung himself, 25 years old. And the newspaper said, you know, he committed suicide, and the priest said he committed suicide, and other people said, you know, I was looking through this stuff. I had a little kid, man. I was like, when I started doing this shit stuff, I just didn't want to feel any more pain. But what he died from was untreated addiction, man. In 1977, corrections and treatment is having a dance. They didn't have that stuff back then, man. People just got locked up, and they, you know, like when you talk about rolling, and they threw the key away, man. That's how we died, man. That's what we did. So I took that, and I took that, and I ran, man. I was like, I'm out of here. You ain't locking me up. You ain't committing me nowhere. I'm not killing myself. And I wound up living on Houston and Avenue B. 13 years old, living with a 55-year-old wino and an abandoned Bell telephone van. And I was panhandling from sun up to sundown. And by 15, I was a full-blown alcoholic and an addict. I was running around uptown, and I was sticking people up on 116th Street. Little old white kid. And I was dying from this disease at that young age. And I didn't care. I lived each one day at a time. Concept when I got here was very easy. That's how I lived my life. One day at a time. Sometimes minute at a time. Wink at a time. Wake up at a time. Next drink at a time. Next robbery at a time. So somehow or another, I wind up by, I say, if I divided the room down the middle, by grace and mercy, and let's take that wing or whatever you call it over there and call it divine intervention. Somehow by those three things, grace, mercy, divine intervention, I wind up back over the bridge into New Jersey. And I was living in an abandoned binium. I was like 17 and a half years old. And I considered myself at the time a rough, tough, rootin' tootin' shooting cowboy. I was insane, criminally insane, no doubt about it. And I got a job with my dad and working at the short order restaurant. And I hit the picket the night before March 24th, 1983. And I remember telling my mom, I'm not going to work. And my mom shaking her little Italian finger at me, and she was like a fortune teller. And she used to say, you know, you're gonna wind up in trouble. And by the time I left the house that day, I vaguely remembered the last time she told me something like that, something bad happened. Vaguely remembered it. And I said to mom, ma'am, I'm all right, I got money in my pocket. I ain't got to steal nothing. I hit the picket the night before. And I went to the bar about 6 in the morning, and my whole family was there. It wasn't abnormal for me to drink in the morning. So I went to this bar 6 in the morning, and I got flagged from the bar by 9. By 1 o'clock in the afternoon, full-blown blackout. The next thing I remember was that day was March 24th, 1983. The next thing I remember, I woke up April 12th. 1983, and I was handcuffed and shackled to a bed, and I had a sheriff officer at the door, and I had a sheriff officer next to my bed, and they said, call the judge. And the judge arranged me in that hospital room that day, just 18 years old now, for 2 counts of first-degree aggravated manslaughter. And I was in a complete, total blackout. When they read me them charges, you might as well told me I went to Mars and back, and it took you from March 24th to April 12th to get here. And like I said, when I growing up, there were two alternatives. Dead before you were 21, doing a life bid before you were 19. I'm a product of my environment. That's what happens when you grow up in this neighborhood. That's what I thought. And I wind up, what happened is I robbed a gas station, and getting away from the gas station, I was in high pursuit chase with New Brunswick Police Department, and I got in a car accident and killed two people. And the judge that arraigned me that day, his name was Barnett Hoffman, very important person later on in amends. And that's when like Mothers Against Drunk Driving was going through Congress and everything like that. And here's a perfect kid we can use for an example. He's got no money to defend himself. First plea bargain, 40 years with a 20-year mandatory minimum. Second plea bargain was 20 years on both counts with 10-year mandatory minimums on both. I finally wind up getting a private lawyer by, like I said, God's grace and mercy and divine intervention. I wind up getting two 10-year sentences with 5-year mandatory minimum on both of them. I went to prison. I was 18. I came back when I was 25. And the day I got out, they sent me to a halfway house. And I want to just talk about for a minute about the lack of proportion and the inability to think straight. That insanity, that thought process that precedes the first drink. I just told you what took place. I just told you what they did to me for that length of time. From 18 to 25 years old, I went away. I come home. They send me to a halfway house. They give me a two-hour pass. And they say, don't people, places, things. The first thing they give you when you sign a pass. What do? I go straight to the train station. And the guys were down there doing the exact same thing they were doing, but instead of drinking Gallaport, they were drinking wine coolers. And I was like, what is that? And the guy was, oh, that's a wine cooler. And I said, well, what is it? He says, oh, it's like soda, and you know, it's not really, it's like a little spritz or something. So I said, let me see it. And exactly to the point of the delusion. And you know that the book talks about that old threadbare idea and there's a solution. I think that old threadbare idea, as a result of working this process for quite a bit of time now, I have observed that old threadbare idea to be just this. Half obsession, half delusion. Exactly that. It's half obsession, half delusion. So I grabbed this bottle and I had this old threadbare idea, this delusion. This lack of proportion and the inability to think straight. And I looked at this bottle of wine or wine cooler and said, that has 7% alcohol. What's that going to do to a guy like me? I drink 100-proof whiskey. Giving no consideration to this illness of sort that we suffer from. You know, this allergy that once I put it in my body, something happens both in my body and in my mental sense that never, ever, ever happens in an average temperate drinker, but always with me, every time, without a shadow of doubt, from the very first time I ever drank. So I drink 7% alcohol, and exactly that kicks in. The allergy kicks in. Now I'm on a two-hour pass. Hour into a two-hour pass, I go into a bar and commit another robbery. Less than 2 hours on the street. Lack of proportion, inability to think straight, cannot be called anything else but insanity. Somehow or another, by God's grace, mercy, divine intervention, I wind up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by God's grace, mercy, and divine intervention, the guy standing up there that night was telling my story. He was a little guy like me, but he wasn't Irish and Italian. He was Puerto Rican, and he was from Harlem, New York. And he was telling his story, and he spent like 14 years in Sing Sing, and now he was a counselor with a master's degree. By the way, my sponsor is Ed F. His sponsor is Lester S. His sponsor is Richie. Richie's sponsor is Ron H. Between us all, we probably got about 85 years inside the penitentiary. And also, since we've been free, since we've been separated from alcohol, since God has entered our hearts in a way that is absolutely miraculous, between us, there's somewhere around 7 master degrees. I know what God can do. I know that God is everything. So somehow or another, I listened to this guy for the first time, and I came around here originally, and I stayed around here about for 4 years or so, and I was waiting for this so-called miracle of AA to rub off. And I waited around here for this miracle of AA to rub off. I want to read you a piece of literature. This is from a pamphlet called Members Eye View. I looked at the literature table. You do not have it. It's P41 if you want to order it. I'm sure you will. Conference-approved literature, ladies and gentlemen. There is a widely held belief in Alcoholics Anonymous that if a newcomer will simply continue to attend meetings, something will finally rub off on them. And the implication, of course, is that there's something that will rub off on them. It's this so-called miracle of AA. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that many people in AA accept this statement quite literally. I have observed them over the years. They faithfully attend meetings, faithfully waiting for something to rub off on them. And the funny part about it, that is something is rubbing off on them, death. They sit here week after week, month after month, in year after year, why physical, mental, and spiritual rigor mortis sets in. Don't tell somebody, don't drink and go to a meeting. Don't give anybody a death sentence. This program is about life and living life abundantly, about getting a relationship with God on a daily basis and improving your lifestyle, the way you live. It's a design for living that really works. It's not about not drinking. Has nothing to do with it. It's a mere beginning. You talked about the process in the book, the 103 pages. They stopped talking about alcohol on the top of 23. These observations are academic and pointless. You read the question today. If therefore we don't take that first drink, setting off the cycle. What cycle? That certainty, that admitting. That inside of me, that every time, whatever, I take alcohol into my system, something happens both in my mind and my body that makes it virtually impossible for me to stop. That cycle. That cycle that had nothing to do with my brother committing suicide. That the first me said, oh, you drank because of your brother's suicide. You drank because your grandmother was murdered. You drank because you spent 15 and a half years in the penitentiary. You drank because of this. No, I didn't. I drank, ladies and gentlemen, for one reason. I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Until it stopped, I did it. Once it stopped working and I couldn't get that effect no more produced by alcohol, I start shooting heroin. After that stopped working, I start going with women and gambling and all this other stuff that I did, even in recovery for a while. I was blocked so much from the sunlight of the spirit, ladies and gentlemen, it was unbelievable. I go on retreat. I have around 8 or 9 years in recovery. I'm in a smoking room. I grab a big book. I had no idea what I'm going to do with a big book that day. But my first spiritual advisor, her name was Lois T. She was from Principles Before Personality groups that meet in Harlem, New York on 155th and 8th Avenue. And Lois T came into the smoking room and she said, what are you doing, baby? And I said, oh, I'm going to write inventory this weekend. No one, two, three, no nothing, but I'm writing inventory. And she said, oh, really? That's nice. And Lois was the type of person that would tell you exactly about yourself. Example. Bring. Hello. Hi, Joey. Hi, Lois. How are you? All right. Did you pray? No. Call me back after you prayed. She was strict. She was precise. She was God-centered, God-fearing, and she knew this process. She didn't call it to work. Page 25 says it's what this process requires. Later on, after they had a little experience from 39 to 55, they talk about it in the sixth step in the 12 and 12. It says they call it that this is the process that enables God to allow us to be what He wanted us to be. Not with the neighborhood, not the role that the neighborhood assigned me. Not my pride being affected by the role I gave you. You know, not my ambitions and security being all screwed up and out of line because of the things I wanted and needed in life that I really didn't even want and need anyway. And she had a clear-cut message. She said, Joey, pick up that book, and I don't want you to look at nothing about inventory. I want you to go to page 59, read everything on page 59, and ask yourself, do you want what I got, and are you willing to go to any length to get it? I read it. And I said, yes, Lois, I definitely want what you got. And let me say this. I don't want to forget to say this. Lois was the first person in Alcoholics Anonymous that I literally wanted what she had. Literally wanted what she had. Not because she had nice cars. She didn't have much. She lived in the Polo Grounds in Harlem on the 6th floor, 155th and 8th. But she had a love. She had a light that was shining in her, inside her, that was abundantly clear. Abundantly clear. And what she had was God. She called it the sunlight of the spirit. And she said, Joey, meet me on 138 and Malcolm X Boulevard Saturday morning. Bring your big book, highlighter, pen, notebook, and everything. And I began this process. And it freed me. I only got maybe 4.5 minutes now. I want to tell you an amen story. I was doing this work for quite a bit of time. I spoke here for the first time maybe about 15 years ago when God freed me from me. When God finally allowed me at once to just... just really stand in his presence. You know, there's a song I was listening to and on the turnpike driving here. It's like, you know, what would I really do if I could? If I stand in front of you, what would I really do? Would I drop to my knees? Would I be able to talk, God? Would I be able to whisper? Could I hear you when you talk to me? I was in Staten Island and Joe Hawk was here from California and he was doing a 9-step a men's workshop. And I knew Joe at the time for quite a while. And he would say, Joey Mack, I want to ask you a question. Did you look up that family yet? And I was like, no, Joe, I ain't. He said, what are you waiting for? He asked me a really, really important question. He said, Joey, how free do you want to be? I don't know how. I don't know how it took place. But the next thing I remember, that was, I was in Staten Island that night. It was a Thursday night. Next thing I remember, it was a Tuesday, and I was in front of a microfilm projector in New Brunswick, New Jersey at Rutgers campus, and I was looking for articles about that day that the crime occurred. And for the longest time, I had the day wrong. I used to think it was March 24th, 1983, and it actually occurred March 23rd, 1983. And I found the article. And I found for the first time who the people were. I mean, really, who they were. And it was a mom. The mom was almost 70. And it was an adult son, like 51. And the mom was a seamstress from Clark, New Jersey. And the son was a union iron worker. And everything was private. And there was no way to make a direct amends to the family. So I called Lois and I was like, I said, this is what happened. This is what Joe told me to do. This is what I did. This is what I found myself doing after some prayer and meditation and asking God for some clear-cut direction. And she said, you know, you tell that story. And you know, when you talk about laying in the bed with the two sheriff officers, call the judge. I said, who? Call the judge. It's all right. So I called the judge, the secretary answers, of course, and at the time he was retired. He's now the chief chairperson for sentencing guideline commissions in the state of New Jersey, and he's my friend today. We speak on panels together. He invites me to come to Rutgers University and speak on transition, talk about reentry into the community from the penitentiary. He talks about it. He says, Joey, I want you to talk about being free. And when I called him, and I called the secretary, I said, you know, my name is Joe McNulty, and Joe, and the judge sentenced me for 2 counts of aggravated manslaughter, and I'm in the program, and I want to make an amends, and my spiritual advisor told me to call the judge. Okay, I'll give him the information. Thank you, Joe. Find out later, years later, I was in a meeting holding hands with a lady, and the lady was the lady to answer the phone. God is good. So he said, the judge wants to know if you want to go to lunch. Excuse me if I go half a minute over, son. The judge wants to know if you want to have lunch with him. Think about that statement I just said. No less the master degree, the judge that sentenced you wants to know if you want to have lunch with him. Of course I would. I go to lunch with him, ladies and gentlemen, and God does for this little kid that grew up in that neighborhood that I described earlier, the miraculous. He gives me a demonstration of faith, ladies and gentlemen, that is beyond this universe. The judge says to me in his quiet little voice that he does, he said, Joey, I want to start a program. I'm tired of these guys coming in front of me and saying every excuse in the world that they're not bad people. You're just sick from this disease. And I want to start a program on EPOD where you were an inmate. Could you help me? And we started the first credited drug and alcohol program in the state of New Jersey inside a correctional facility as a part of an amends and a part of me cleaning up a little bit of the records of my past. I can literally stand here for hours talking about amends stories. I've recently discovered that in this process that we go through with this book, that there's a whole new thing happening. And what's happening is, along with the atheists and agnostics and believers and disbelievers that come into this program, there's some people that have been around here for a while that actually know this book from front to back, from back to front, asking what page inventory is on. They'll tell you. They'll tell you where the seven-step prayer is, the third-step prayer, what they read every morning. But they don't have any experience with it. I have experience with this book for almost 18 years now. I've been here 21. And when I close, I use this same pamphlet, P41. So whoever's in charge of litter, get in the ball. And I end with this story in this pamphlet about John the Baptist, and his conference approved, languishing for the third or fourth time in Harris Prison. And the following is said. It comes from the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts a time when John the Baptist was languishing in a prison of Harris, and hearing the works of his cousin Jesus, sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou not the Messiah, or should we wait for another?" And the Lord replied to them in this parable, and they said to the followers of John the Baptist, to only go and tell John what you have seen, and only go back and tell John what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see. Tell John that the deaf hear. Tell John that the lame walk. And tell John that the gospel is brought to those who are poor in spirit. And in this text, this pamphlet, P41, get on the ball. When they use the word gospel, they're simply talking about one thing, the good news. So if you can accept the report from me tonight, from this little Irish-Italian kid that been to hell and back, based on my experience, strength, and hope, through my longest days and my darkest nights in this program, I could tell you that I know that the blind see. I know that the lame walk. And I most know certainly, certainly from the bottom of my heart and the depths of my soul that the good news of this program is brought to those who are poor in spirit. May God bless you and hold you. Thank you.